Welcome to the Money Maze podcast. I'm Simon Brewer, and we've created this show to explore and unravel some of the mysteries surrounding the investment business. And we hope through direct and insightful interviews with masters of the real-life money maze, we're going to learn about different approaches to allocating capital, making investment and business decisions, and navigating the pitfalls that line the paths to prosperity. Whether you're a current or aspiring investor or a student exploring career options, we hope you gain some helpful insights and enjoy the shows. Thank you for listening. Today is a first for us to welcome a Grand Chancellerie de la Légion d'honneur, the highest French decoration to reward the most deserving citizens. Additionally, a Knight of the British Empire. Listed in Harvard's 2017 Business Review as one of the best 100 CEOs in the world and recorded in Debrett's as one of the most influential people in finance, a former member of Prime Minister Cameron's Business Advisory Group and previous head of the London Stock Exchange, and our first Frenchman on the show. Sir Xavier Rollet, bienvenue to the Money Maze podcast.
Thank you. It seems that Brexit is changing things. You're allowing French people on your show now.
It's progress. It's the Entente Cordiale.
I hope it's not desperation.
We might return to that interesting subject later on. You were born to military parents and initially brought up in Algeria, as I understand it. For those of a certain age, it has echoes of the Day of the Jackal. But what were your memories?
Well, I was a little boy at the time. And of course, memories 60 years later tend to present probably a warped picture or modified picture of what it was. But what I do remember are the explosions. These were the times where the Algerians had rebelled against the colonial authorities. I won't go back the whole details of how that came about. But there was essentially paramilitary insurrection, so French on French, Algerians on French. We were growing up in a really poor part of eastern Algiers called Regaya. You regularly heard explosions. And ultimately, the French left, and we came back to France as many hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of French citizens or residents who lived in Algeria, pretty traumatized and having to basically start all over.
So you then are relocated to, I think, what's been described as a tough eastern Paris suburb. And from there, you get to both Kedge Business School and ultimately to Columbia. And also during that journey, become a lieutenant in the French Air Force. Just give us a little color as to how those steps unfolded.
The place I grew up in eastern Paris is what would be described in the UK as a sink estate. Quickly realized that professional opportunities were, for me, unlikely to be maximized in France, and I quickly embarked on the long-term project to emigrate to the United States, which I did in the early 80s, having secured a university degree in France.
I'm intrigued at what it was that you thought and what actually happened in terms of what the U.S. university system was going to give you.
For me, it was freedom. It was a society where hard work and motivation, talent, if you have any, but it's not required. It's better if you do. And we can argue as to what the right mix between hard work and talent, but also the willingness to innovate, to do things differently, to persevere, were rewarded. It felt, and it still feels to me today, that European societies are characterized by a level of immobility and immutable establishment, which hinders the opportunities for advancement, the opportunities for growth, and more importantly, the opportunities for innovation. And America, to me, struck me as a very different country from that standpoint.
I'd like to start now with a career. You joined Goldman Sachs in 1984, and you stay there for a decade. Now, I need to make a confession at this point, because 1 year later than you joined Goldman Sachs, I was leaving the LSE and went for an interview with Goldman's. And having done my research and been reliably informed by a flatmate that what I needed to say was that I wanted to join their private wealth management business to be a portfolio manager, I said that when asked by these very smart executives at Goldman's, to which they replied, "We don't do that." And I then said, well, I'm very flexible. And unfortunately, the interview ended shortly thereafter. So I had a slightly different path. But 10 years at Goldman Sachs, not an easy place to survive and thrive. Tell me a little bit about why it worked so well for you.
It was pretty brutal, if I am completely candid about my assessment, particularly the first 12 months. I got a job in the international risk arbitrage department, where essentially the firm, having built a reputable franchise in the United States, hired me to help expand in the U.S. their presence in the trading of international securities. So I was thrown basically in the deep end of equity trading from the 29th floor of 85 Broad Street, working with people who have all made a mark in the industry and frankly far more significant than anything I could hope to do. And I was given the opportunity to learn from people who essentially had invented the modern equity trading, particularly block trading and corporate equity trading business from, of course, a strong base in the United States. But later on, I had the opportunity to take that expertise to the London office. And that was for me like a second MBA. But the first 12, 18 months were really brutal. Imagine you're a foreign kid. Maybe you speak English well. Maybe you've got an MBA. But learning how to trade U.S. listed stocks on the floor of the exchange, building a relationship with institutions around the United States, understanding the way risk was committed, blocks were underwritten at a pace that essentially was unmatched and still, in my opinion, is unmatched today anywhere in the world. So let me just describe it as a very, very steep learning curve, for lack of a better word. And without the relative civility that you would encounter on the trading floor today, assuming trading floors survive COVID-19, there was a lot of yelling, a lot of screaming, and a lot of, on occasion, the more physical marks of anger or tension. Of course, the amounts traded were huge, but let's say that it was not the civil environments that, perhaps more genteel environment that Europeans were used to, even at the time, in their financial services industry.
Somebody sent me a recruitment video of Goldman Sachs back from about 84, 85, and I watched it a few months ago. And the most notable thing was all these people smoking cigarettes on the trading floor, sort of 4 inches from each other. It was another world. But it gives you the springboard to become head of European equities at CSFB, then to become global head of risk at Dresdner Kleinwort, and eventually head of global equity trading and head of Lehman Brothers in France. But why do you think you were successful?
I think what really gave me an opportunity to succeed, and anyone would probably like to attribute themselves to whatever hard work, whatever abilities they had, but it was really the people, folks like David Silfen, Bob Rubin, Bob Mnuchin, Eric Scheinberg, what they taught me at the time, essentially a very green European graduate with just a couple of years of business school experience under my belt, throwing me at the forefront of financial technology at the time. And I think what they taught me, besides the skills and how you handle yourself in this environment, is really how to think of risk and how do you think of how a corporate culture can help you manage risk properly. And Goldman at the time had a very different corporate culture than he does today, but still the corporate culture that he had developed at the time enabled it to navigate some of the toughest market correction, crashes, geopolitical environments in a way that kept it ahead of the competition. And so that probably made a mark in terms of my own thinking, is how to handle risk, particularly in those difficult moments where you are at a disadvantage, or you've made the wrong decision, or you are going, and this is probably what characterizes my career, including what happened at the LSE and later on in terms of the business development, of not being afraid to go against the grain. Consensus is something that is typically eagerly sought out by boards and basically by human beings. That's not how you make money in the markets. You have to be able to, based on analysis, based on your judgment, based on whichever factor you're going to be able to collect, to determine a path to value creation or to innovation that is different from consensus analysis, consensus approach, consensus management techniques. And this is something that I believe I learned there.
And when you look back at your last stint before the London Stock Exchange, which was Lehman Brothers, where was the fault line? Was it in the culture that wasn't able to balance all of those interests and moved excessively?
I started at Lehman Brothers in the New York office, where I became co-head of global equity and derivatives trading, basically the global risk. And after 9/11, as we were looking to move people around, I came back to London and assumed responsibility for businesses in Asia and Europe, but still in the equity area. Where I think the Lehman bankruptcy, and Lehman was probably, in my own humble opinion, was motivated by, like all the other investment banks, to be the best and to be tops. Catching Goldman Sachs was the sort of thing that people were talking about. And in some respects, it had achieved that. In some respects, it hadn't. I think in the hurry, when I joined Lehman Brothers, I was there about 9 years. The company was worth about $2 billion and had less than 2,500 employees. And by the time I left, it was worth $45 billion and had 37,000 employees. So that's both great, but also an issue in the sense that it was in such a hurry to grow and catch up. And it had a natural ability to manage risk properly at the senior most level of the company. It had developed essentially through risk management. But it, I think, started to cut corners because it was in a hurry and doing things in a way that laid the seed of trouble that eventually hit it. I don't think Lehman Brothers went bust because of its equities position, its traditional fixed income positions. It was out by the second quarter of 2007. It was already out of the subprime market, which is usually credited for bringing an end to the bull market and essentially crashing the economy at the time. And in fact, if you go back to a report published in March 2016 by Rick Rieder, who was at the time head of credit at Lehman Brothers, he published a 130-page report that in it, if you had read it, forecast predicted a major market crash and correction in the third quarter of 2008, which sounds unbelievable if you consider it from the perspective of being a senior Lehman executive saying, watch out. From a credit standpoint, I think we're going to have a major negative event in the third or fourth quarter of 2008. So the Lehman leadership knew what was going on. I think what caught up with Lehman is that ambition to catch up with the leaders, that ambition to be number one. And if you look at what happened in 2007, I was late in 07 and early 08. I'd moved to Paris where I'd become the CEO of Lehman's operations there. So could only see this from a distance. But it looked like in the third and fourth quarter of 2007, Lehman made some major bets in U.S. commercial property, hundreds of billions, which were booked in the fixed income division as commercial property at the time reported essentially and under the leader of the fixed income division. And unlike Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, and many other investment banks, those illiquid commercial property investments were not booked in private equity instruments that did not and still don't require mark to market. They were booked inside essentially the trading book. And I believe regulators at the time required Lehman to price them at the market. And since there were no pricing tools directly connected to commercial real estate, they had to use indices, which, as of course they were tanking at the time, projected Lehman into a very, very difficult financial position. So some of these investments ultimately made money, but Lehman was in such a hurry at the time that they didn't think through all the governance aspects and were not in the position to withstand the pressures of credit scrutiny the way other firms, who frankly, whether you look at Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, Merrill Lynch, were in an equally bad position. And none of these companies were in a position to survive had it not been for the intervention of the federal government. And I think the second aspect of Lehman Brothers, being in such a hurry and so focused on economic production, is they probably did not invest as much time in developing their regulatory and political relationships. I think in 2008, they paid the price for that. So that's my unadulterated position or view on the subject.
Resume of the situation. Thank you very much. And then in March 2009, you joined the LSE, and by May, you're its chief executive. And it appears you clearly had a vision. I went back over the charts and saw that the share price effectively went from £6 to £40 on your watch. That's a compounded rate of over 25% per annum. And during that time, you acquired Turquoise, ClearNet, Frank Russell, Citibank's Global Fixed Income Index. Clearly, you had a master plan. How did that come about?
Master plan, which actually I got my first long-term incentive plan at £4 when I joined, at £3.88 when I joined. I still have the stamp marker. The LSE had a set of short-term issues and challenges at the time. The company was losing about, it was essentially a monoline product, UK equity trading and IPOing, and primary basically and secondary markets for UK equities, and was losing about 1% market share every week from a position of a former monopoly, deregulated in part owing to MiFID in January 2007, and was losing market share at a rapid pace. And that would not have happened without greater support from the client base. So there was clearly a, without going into details, large delta, a rift. And it was not just the case of the LSE, by the way, that had been allowed to grow between the management of these exchanges and the clients. The client base was deeply dissatisfied. Poor technology, high fees, and a range of other issues. In 2007, 2008, 2009, happened in Europe, we brought down the cost of operating the UK equity engine by about 85%, which gives you a sense of the savings that could accrue to clients. But that was really, frankly, a small part of the strategy. So the first part was, let's get ourselves in shape and let's repair our relationship with our core client base. September 2009, I set up a strategy presentation to shareholders and clients alike. Few people came, and I think even fewer believed what we said we would do. What we articulated and what I said at the time is the vocation of a company like the LSE, known, of course, for its IPOs and its equity trading, is really to be a financial infrastructure company. We are here to serve others, investors, banks, retail investors, but also users of balance sheet services. We were at a time where post the crisis, the cost of regulatory capital for banks was going through the roof. They had failed. Regulators essentially did not want them to keep the same exposure to securities that they had in the past. So we determined a three-pronged strategy. First, to develop to about a third of our revenues balance sheet products, which the LSE had never handled before. Clearing, collateral management, settlement. The second area was data. Data and particularly intellectual property, branded data. So we went into the index business with FTSE, with Frank Russell, with MTS, with the TMX fixed income franchise, etc. And the strategy was this: if we managed to establish a global profile, balance sheet, and branded intellectual property, then we will get the trading flows. So we did 25 acquisitions in about 8 years. Managed to transform the company from a UK equity trading platform under severe pressure. Some at the time said terminal. I remember some of the expression in the articles in the FT or Reuters, last nail in the coffin or roadkill was the way we were usually described at the time. But the third layer, which I think in the long run and at the time was the most important, and without which we couldn't have made all these acquisitions, is that we needed to urgently repair our relationship with our clients, all our clients, asset management, banks, retail brokers, individual traders. and the third layer in the success we enjoyed. Innovation is driven by clients and client issues and challenges. If you focus on that and are not afraid, you know, we left the World Federation of Exchanges and the Federation of European Stock Exchanges. I think that ability to innovate is what enabled us, for example, to become the biggest clearinghouse in the world, offering G20 services in clearing, for example, taking the US market, the Japanese market, because we had the backing of clients. Innovation, to me, is the key. That should be the number one on any listed or private company board.
Well, this could be termed value creation par excellence, and I hope that somebody is putting it into a business school module to be studied. Now, I'd like to talk a little bit about wealth creation. So I listened to a speech you gave at Oxford, and you said something that's central to the Money Maze podcast. The only asset that creates wealth is equities. You didn't add, but implicit in that statement is that otherwise you're a rentier, someone who lives off income. It may seem obvious, but I'm really keen to unpick exactly what you meant.
Yes, I think it's at the heart of the debate, in my opinion, about why Europe has lagged so much in terms of competitiveness, economic growth, job creation. And this is all before COVID. So let's not bring COVID in this, because it makes things actually accentuates the trend even more. But the ability that the United States, and it's really the only country in the world that does this the way they do, to convert innovation, scientific or service innovation or any kind of innovation, into societal value on the scale that they do it is remarkable. Now, there was an article in The Economist, I think it was the December 2016 issue, that said that out of the 100 most successful startups in the world by capitalization since 1975, only one was European. 24 were from California, 15 were from the US, ex-California. Only one out of the EU, including the UK at the time. And that's where Europe, I think, either doesn't understand or has decided not to avail itself of the power of equity markets to scale up innovation. And it could be private equity, it could be listed equity. This is not a stock exchange pitch. And if you look at today, the amount of financial assets that exist in the world, it's almost like a pyramid in reverse. At the very top, over $250 billion worth of interest rate swaps, notional value. As you go down, it gets smaller. Foreign exchange, sovereign debt, corporate debt, credit default swaps. And then all the way down, less than 5% today of the overall value financial assets in the world are equities. Yet equity is what drives the whole capitalist system. It is the message, the signal that investors most trust to analyze and conclude as to the financial health of a particular company. One of the reasons why recently Financial News or The Telegraph, I argued against closing equity markets, if you at all could keep them open in the context of COVID, is because they send an essential feedback loop to not just investors, but also policymakers. If a government takes a particular initiative in the context of COVID, and the markets like it or don't like it, whichever it is, that's an essential feedback loop. So they are, even though they are small in terms of their nominal value, possibly the most important signal in terms of value creation. And there is no other instrument. Put yourself in the shoes of an entrepreneur. Let's say you've worked for a university for 15 years. You've come up with some great innovation, something that you think is going to solve a particular issue. It could be software, it could be healthcare, it could be a disease. Something of value. You don't have much money. You need to get that company set up. You go to your bank. They're going to ask you for some liens. They're going to ask you to service that debt month one. I know rates are very low today, but from the get-go, you have, as an entrepreneur and as an innovator, to worry about making your monthly payments. That's not how you develop overseas market. That's not how you develop new drugs or new software or new technology solutions, frankly, new services. You need patient, long-term capital. It works better for entrepreneurs. And in Europe, we have a fiscal and regulatory framework that is deeply punitive, that is almost confiscatory as it relates to equities versus the way it treats debt, particularly bank debt. So there's an inherent, a deep bias, fiscal bias for sure, and I also believe regulatory bias in favor of debt. As a result, many companies that could, insurance companies, for example, pension funds, when I started at the stock exchange in early 2009, 65% of the assets of British pension funds. And I attended a conference at the National Association of Pension Funds. It was in Edinburgh that year. About a little over two-thirds of their assets were invested in equities. Today, it's less than 15%. Why? Because legislation like Solvency II makes it impossible for a pension fund, for an insurance company, and there are a set of other regulatory requirements, makes it impossible for them to make equity bets. So we are draining in the UK and Europe, we're draining the equity pool. Whereas in the US, as we see it, the equity pools have never been as active as they are today. And guess what? Which economy is recovering faster? Which sector today? I'm always asked the question, why are equity indices performing so well in the US? Why are the markets so strong in the face of so much pain? And I say to people, indices, they retain the winners. Look at the importance and impact of tech stocks who are benefiting from the consequences of COVID, the Amazons and the Googles. That's what you're buying when you're buying the indices. So a strongly technology-focused economy, which has and offers entrepreneurs deep, easy-to-tap equity markets with a lot of relevant investor experience so as to fund their ideas and initiative, not through the intermediary of the banking system. Politicians, policymakers in Europe always refer to funding for the corporate sector, it was referred to bank lending. That actually accounts for 80% of all the sources of corporate funding in Europe and the UK, and actually the share is growing. That is not the right way to scale up an economy. So what I've called for, frankly, publicly for some time, and I'm not the only one in that position, is a wholesale recalibration of the fiscal and regulatory regime that pertains to equities, to give equities a fair chance compared to debt. You're not going to build the Googles and the Teslas and the SpaceXs of the world with debt.
So let's talk about innovation. You sent me a piece entitled "Everyone Knows Innovation is Essential to Business Success, Except Board Directors." And an extraordinary survey by Boris Groysberg of Harvard Business School concluded that for board members of companies around the world, technology and innovation don't make the top three on their list of concerns. To use the French word, incroyable. How do you process this?
Shocking but true. But a board assignment is seen as something you do towards the tail end of your career, a little bit before the sunset. And it's something people talk about. They put on their business card. I'm on the board of this, the board of that. And the governance has, frankly, in many cases, and we see examples of this everywhere, not worked sufficiently well because in times of management mistakes or substantial changes in the confirmation of the markets, companies have not been able to react quickly enough and find themselves in active mode. Companies should focus on securing board members who actually have had a personal experience of successful innovation. And, you know, if you look at the number of board members who own equity in the companies that they're a board member of, it's almost unheard of. It's actually discouraged in many countries, including this one. So here again, the lack of equity participation does not attract the right candidates or does not help focus their attention on what a company is about. It's about solving problems for customers. It can be through technology, it could be through new ideas, it could be through different services. And solving these issues, making our lives better, is what helps create value. And the equity mindset is, in my opinion, today, the number one difference between the United States economy and every other economy in the world. And this may change in the US. There are some forces at work that could create a shift of focus. But at the moment, the US is the only economy in the world that has innovation and value creation through equity markets as the central driving part of its economy, not as a marginal, miscellaneous, overlooked, and unloved by fiscal authorities, treasuries, and regulators, because it's seen as quote unquote risky. Let me ask you today, what's riskier, investing in a technology startup or buying government bonds, a 30 or 40 year horizon of nations where the debt to GDP ratios adjusted for all the off balance sheet items far exceed 400 to 500%? So that argument as a regulator that government debt can be a very risky investment indeed.
We could have another podcast on the absurdity of locking in negative real yields for a long time. But I'd like to just talk a bit about the French economic model in the context of Europe. De Gaulle famously said, how can you govern a country which has 246 varieties of cheese? But we have, on the one hand, a German model that has been essentially invest, produce, consume, and an Anglo-Saxon model, certainly the UK model, which has been too much consumption and not enough investment. And we have France, I think, lying maybe somewhere in between. What are the two things you would like to see France do? Put a spark under what has been an extraordinarily disappointing 30 years of industrial production.
It really has been. It's been a long, basically, descent into an abyss of a lack of economic competitiveness. And we're seeing this today because ultimately it impacts everything else you do. Your ability to invest in defense, your ability to be taken seriously on the geopolitical stage, your economic strength.
I thought Macron understood the need for change.
The bet that he made, you know, a year before the election, created a new party, won both the parliamentary elections as well as the presidential election, from being a junior minister on the finance minister in charge with the what they call numerical economy, namely technology and technological development. And he was someone that, and I still think does, really understand the edge that scaling up technological innovation into creating globally successful competitors. He really understands that. I had several conversations with him. What from my standpoint disappointing is, in terms of the reforms, if any were made, I have not seen really the evidence of any economic reforms in the last 3 years. Let me give you an example. France has a 250 billion euro state-owned portfolio of public housing. It has about 5 million units of public housing, and with a fairly dire need of another 1.5 million to house people properly. That's all in the hands of the state. This could be a fantastic privatization, not just to imitate what was successfully done in the UK. Clearly, the idea was not mine, but because it could help raise 250 billion euros for the state, but in a way that could put ownership of your own residence at the lower end of the social spectrum in the hands of French citizens, starting to develop a culture of ownership, ownership of your home, ownership of stocks. Having that retail, even if it's particular to France, which is not a massive economy, it's a country of 63 million people, but giving individuals the ability to become actors in the stock market, that opportunity has been completely missed, was highlighted to him in great details. The opportunity to recalibrate the treatment of bank debt, which benefit from deductibility. Do you know how much the deductibility of debt in the financial services sector cost European Treasury, namely European taxpayers? I have the 2016 and 17 numbers. It was almost 400 billion euros a year of foregone income. The flip side of that is equities are taxed, the same euro or sterling of equity income, the same one is taxed 4 times through its lifetime. Financial transaction tax, which is called stamp duty in the UK, income tax, capital gains, and dividend. That comes of the same income, the same euro or pound of income. Frankly, this started with the candidacy of President Giscard. President Chirac never campaigned on the basis of being a reformer. The socialist administration of President Mitterrand took a lot of fiscally hostile decisions to the real economy. They did make some reforms, to their credit, in terms of modernizing the regulation of equity markets. They did modernize it. Nicolas Sarkozy, Hollande, and the Macron administration, they've really done nothing. So I fear that the rather immense ability that France would have to convert what is a good university and academic environment into technology winners has once again been missed. And I think at the stage where we are today, it's just too late. And I think today it's fair to say that the United States is the only country in the world that has the depth of equity markets appropriate and necessary to scale up that technological innovation and that innovation period to global leaders. That's what I would like to see in general in Europe, more of it in the UK. The UK is probably doing better than the rest of the continent. The UK before COVID had 5.4 million SMEs versus about 2.3 million in France and 2.6 million in Germany. Germany is famed for its Mittelstand, its famous Mittelstand. But if you look at the reality of the Mittelstand, these are family businesses doing very well, offering high quality machines, services, having developed over many decades, a real sort of export-driven prowess. But in the area of startups and technological innovation, whether you look at healthcare, agritech, software, Germany is not an innovative country. But on the side of innovation, whether you look at Italy, France, Germany, Spain, there's no scaling up of that startup environment. And to me, that is the probably number one reason why Europe continues to underperform massively in terms of economic growth, job creation.
Now, you are sitting here in London. London's been the preeminent financial capital in Europe and one of the two or three in the world. We're about to have the final denouement of the Brexit discussions here. And some people have been very keen to suggest that that goes hand in hand with London's demise. And yet, big financial centres of history are being much more resilient. And I wonder just what your own perspective on that, given that in the rankings of global financial centres, the highest European city is Zurich, down at 10th.
I think the reason London is there is because it is not UK, not European, but global. The London Clearing House has seized, just to give you an example, over 90% of a $250 billion market, the global market for interest rate swap clearing, has seized it from the CME in the US, from the JSCC in Japan, because it created a global engine where banks and asset managers can bring their interest rate swaps in all the G20 currencies, clear them, and derive massive, massive compression benefits, huge savings for their balance sheet. No one else anywhere in the world is able to do that. So whilst the US leads, in my opinion, in terms of economic value creation and scaling up of technology, because of the sophistication of its investors and the depth of its equity market, around the general broad picture of financial services, London, I mentioned clearing, I could have mentioned foreign exchange, I could have mentioned financial services, leads because it offers a complete suite of global services. And it's not just the advice that is provided in London, but historically has also been the willingness and the ability of London-based institution to give you a principal underwriting, i.e., a solution to your risk issues. If you had a particular risk you didn't like or risk you wanted to acquire, London, you could find expertise in London, very competitively provided, that would advise you on the best way to do it, but then offer you a principal-based solution, i.e., you don't like that risk, we'll take it off your hands at a price. We're not communist. We want remuneration. But that is an expertise that does not exist in Europe. and frankly exists up to a limited extent in the United States. Most of the risk intermediation in the U.S. was done on a best effort, on a what we call an agency basis. You take the order and you try to find the other side. And so I think as long as London maintains a global set of expertise and the willingness to principal the risk, to underwrite the risk, it will retain that function. If as a result of Brexit or other conditions or other factors, it loses big chunks of that global expertise. For example, it's clear that the strategy of the EU and many European capital is to take as much of the expertise that's in London as pertains to the euro currency, to take it back to the eurozone. And that so far has not been successful. Most people don't know that 75% of euro-denominated flows in the eurozone market originate from outside the EU. It's essential to keep those European capabilities in London because they are offered in conjunction with a bunch of other global currencies. And it's that combined that gives London a unique expertise. You know, people talk about Hong Kong, you know, less than 40 international non-Hong Kong, non-Chinese companies are listed on the Hong Kong Stock Exchange. It's not a global exchange.
So when I spoke about your education, I missed off one thing, which is you went and did a postgraduate study in national defense studies. And given your expertise and understanding in finance, business, running businesses, and then defense, surely you must be thinking that the next role should be pitching for president of France.
Surely not. Thank you very much. First of all, I have neither the talent, the abilities, nor the ambition. In the political arena, I do get that question from time to time. We're seeing some early indications today that there can be solutions to geopolitical problems that were perceived before to be intractable. I do think comprehensive peace settlement is going to happen in the Middle East. We are going to see a resolution of the issues in the Koreas. The status quo, the standstill arrangements of the past, in both cases, have been completely changed. Everybody has to recompute. And if that happens, if I'm correct, and we do see an era where these geopolitical issues can be resolved, at the time where hopefully we will start finding solutions, whether it's to COVID, healthcare is also a global issue. I think this notion that the nation is going to have its own vaccine, not share it elsewhere, both in terms of research and distribution, it's nonsense. It's nonsense economically. It's nonsense in terms of the effectiveness of that particular vaccine, given the complexity that the characteristics of these viruses. So I think we're being brought back to reality of a more cooperative world. But for this to work, we need some global governance. And if that happens, just don't be short the market, my friend.
Now, that's a good time to talk about wine. You are an échansonnerie de Châteauneuf-du-Pape, which is like a brotherhood for winemakers, and you and your wife own the Chen Bleu label at La Verrière, which has been dubbed the first Rhone supergrowth. Now, I have a passion for wine. I've not drunk your wine yet, but a wise enologist and friend, Chris Van Aken, said that one of the big issues is that the trend across so many wine-making regions is about the success of natural wines, i.e. very limited sulfur and highly organic. But with that push towards naturalism, is quality being slightly suppressed?
Well, I would argue actually the opposite. It was back in 1994. So some time ago, when we found that property, it was completely abandoned, had been for about 45 years. It was a ruin, but it was in a pristine area, which actually today is part of the UNESCO biosphere and a national park. And so we rebuilt the place, and we brought back the vineyard to life using biodynamic principles right away, which is a combination of organic treatments. And by the way, organic is not a panacea. Copper, sulfur are organic. They're not synthetic. And many organic farms who do not use synthetic products will use so much copper or so much sulfur that you can damage your product, you can damage the health of your customers, you can damage your soil as well. 99% of wineries use PVPP, which is microplastics, polyvinyl to find their wines, particularly rosés and whites. And there are some organic equivalents that are completely natural that you could use. It's a bit more expensive, but most people just poo-poo them. So we thought we needed to watch and care for the entire chain, not just production, not just soil management. And it's not obvious if you take over a winery that's been chemically managed for 40 years. The first 5 to 10 years are going to be very difficult. But eventually, as you restore diversity of crops, birds, insects, animals of all sorts, you're going to see a much, much higher quality fruit. And then you can do marvels with that in the winery. Anyway, that's our contention, and that's what we're offering our clients.
I will look forward to my first tasting.
I'll send you a bottle. Now, do you like red or white or rosé?
I'd love to drink your red. I'm a great fan of the Châteauneuf du Pape and Rhône wines.
All right, I'll send you some of the red.
You are the first person I've met who's competed in the, what was the Paris-Dakar rally, now the Dakar rally, the legendary 10,000-kilometer trip to the Senegalese capital of Dakar. Now, that's off-piste, or should I say that's off-exchange. How did you get involved in that?
I had some friends in the business. I'm a little bit of an old Africa hand. I've been traveling to Africa I grew up there when I was a kid. The Sahara in particular, even though it's a troubled part of the world today from a security standpoint, is an incredibly diverse, complex, beautiful. It's huge. It's the second largest desert in the world. But it's incredibly rich in wildlife, fauna, flora, archaeology. Having friends in the racing business, I've always been interested in machines and four-wheel drive and a few other things. But although I may be a bit too old for that, there are still people racing the Dakars in their mid to late 60s. I think racing through Rouba Khali, the empty quarter, going into the Nefoud and Wadi Rum towards Jordan, doing the loop around Saudi Arabia, has got to be one of the most beautiful desert races in the world. I've done also the Transoriental in the Mongolia and the Sertoès and other parts of North Africa. But the Arabian Peninsula has got to be very special.
So for our youth audience, thinking about careers and possible directions, what advice would you offer those thinking about finance?
Look, as much as you can, learn all the classical tools. So do put in the time, it's in school, university, whatever it is. Learn the tools. It's always useful. But in my humble opinion, what has happened in the past, what you kind of hear from the establishment, whether they're people who are part of the establishment, say they are or say they're not, that's not what's going to help you in your career. Once you acquire the tool, if you can, work under somebody who is at the core an innovator. And the pace at which innovation is changing our world is accelerating every day. So look to the future, be humble when you start, but the brand, the name of the firm where you work, that was helpful 20, 30 years ago. Today, it's really mostly who the person is that is going to give you that early approach, analytical mind, innovative, inquisitive mind, and focus on innovation. The leaders today are not going to be around. Forget about even being leaders in 10 years from now. Quantum computing and communication is going to drastically change every aspect of our lives. So do spend time whilst you're in university. Look into these things. Look into quantum computing. Look into quantum communications. The world is going to change drastically. Focus on innovation and learning from people who can actually share with you their innovative experience. Don't be too bothered about what happened in the past.
So I have two final questions. When travel returns and life resumes some form of normality, where's the first place you'd like to go on holiday?
I'm just coming back from my favorite place, which is Montana. I'm a citizen of the world. And this wasn't a holiday, actually. I had a conservation mandate, which took me 3 months to accomplish. I think all countries are beautiful. Every country in the world has these special places. Even those that are not deemed to be tourist hotspot, there's always something different you can find because you meet the people there. And I've always traditionally been a student of history, archaeology, and old languages. And I find a great deal of satisfaction And whenever you travel around the world, meeting people and trying to connect the sense of their own history and the history of their language with where they are today. So I'm pretty flexible. Sorry to frustrate your question.
I had to smile because you're the second guest when asked where he would go, mentions Montana. We were lucky enough to have Davy Arrow, who is now one of the world's most celebrated photographers, on the show. And that was his single destination, if he could only go to one place in the world.
And David is a good friend. I love his pictures. In fact, he invited us on, he did a Montana shoot 2 years ago to go in and watch the shoot. And unfortunately, at the time, it was in March, February, March. He couldn't do it. But I have some of his pictures about taken in Montana. Again, the fear is that as the attention focuses on that state, give it 5 years and they'll be gone. But there are some secret parts of Montana that I think will never be developed. This is what you want to find going around the world. Can you find a special place in a special part of the world that has, as part of its governance, built in some protections against the abuse by either agriculture, mining, oil and gas, or whatever it may be?
So my final question before I let you go is that you have to tell me the bottle of wine that you want to drink in the restaurant that you have to choose, but it can't be your wine. What will it be and where will it be?
I have a particular fondness for Pomerol in Bordeaux, which, loyal to my, I wouldn't say anti-establishment, but my approach, which isn't based on the past. Pomerol is the one area that's not part of the original Grand Cru system. So it's a little outlier out there. But I do love the Pomerol. Le Pin is one of my favorite. I have to say that we know the owners, their friends, and what they've done with a property which 30, 40 years ago wasn't that well known is also remarkable. But Le Pin is one of my favorites. But they are getting recognition. In the temperate parts of the world, north and south, you can make great wines everywhere.
Well, back in 1984, when you joined Goldman Sachs, I worked for Stag's Leap in the Napa Valley. And I cleaned barrels and I learned some things that I didn't imagine I would and learned to love the wine. So there we go.
No, Stag's Leap, and these guys have done very well. It must have been a great experience. But if I told people today that Australian vineyards, Australian vines are much older than French vineyards, they would look at me with like, but that's the truth. Australian vineyards are, the rootstock is much older than French rootstock, of course, because of phylloxera. So the wine industry is not, in my opinion, necessarily well served by too much respect for the past. It's important to have a good track record, long-term track record of quality, but it's also a method of agriculture which, besides being very homomorphic, anthropomorphic, also needs innovation. And that's what Australians, Americans, South Africans, and others have brought to the plate. It's good to shake the tree a little bit.
Well, Xavier, this conversation could run and run, but I'm going to let you go. But I'm going to just recap on two really important points that you've made, which is, number one, great businesses must think about, and above all else, solving problems for the customer. And too often that's forgotten. And secondly, for young people, and for those a little older, innovation is key. And thinking about careers, you need to think about who are going to be the innovators and work with them rather perhaps than taking some of the more traditional routes that we all know too well.
Yes. If I were in the shoes of a 20-year-old today or 25-year-old scratching their head saying, you know, what am I going to study? Where am I going to go? Learn all the classic tools, but study with institutions that reserve some importance to innovation. And I would say the same message for even successful companies, quoted companies. Innovation is the key, and that's driven by customer issues.
Fantastic. Xavier, thank you so much.
Nice talking to you.
Thank you for listening to the Money Maze podcast. For more information or to subscribe, please visit themoneymazepodcast.com. Hope to see you next time. All content on the Money Maze podcast is for your general information and use only, and is not intended to address your particular requirements. In particular, the content does not constitute any form of advice, recommendation, representation, endorsement, or arrangement, and is not intended to be relied upon by users in making any specific investment or other decisions. Guests and presenters may have positions in any of the investments discussed.